If a single company is a metaphorical tree, then today we will zoom out to take stock of the entire forest. For the next two episodes, we will take a little pause from the GGOB book so that we can look at some recent Harvard research for a crucial macro view. You see, there's a commonly misunderstood, yet widespread part of business that is as emotionally touchy as politics. Of course, I'm referring to outsourcing. Hello and welcome. This book club podcast is for teams tackling issues of both human capital and financial capital, especially now in the wake of mass automation, not only a factor in retail jobs, but also displacement of white-collar work too. I'm Esther Tang, an avid reader and manufacturer of turbochargers. Almost a decade ago, I came across SRC, a wildly successful company in Missouri, USA. SRC harnesses human participation in an extraordinary all-hands-on-deck method that they call the Great Game of Business, or GGOB. It's an engaging and effective business operating system that works as a game, and it's been quietly helping hundreds of businesses to leapfrog ahead in widespread wealth creation. Let me ask you this. Have you ever considered moving to a new city, maybe a new state or across country? Chances are, in planning the move, you factored in cost of living. What's the average home price in the new city? How long would your commute to work be? Would the kids have good schools? Would one income be sufficient to live comfortably? How good is the pizza? You know, all the important stuff. In the same way that you, a responsible planning person, considers where to live, so must a business consider similar questions. We all know that no man is an island. Turns out, no business is either. May I start us with two historical accounts? First, remember the IT revolution in the 1990s? At that time, in the official trade category of high technology, the U.S. had a newly forming trade deficit with mainland China. A large chunk of that deficit was comprised of computer equipment. The U.S. had a voracious appetite for IT. Web-related companies cropped up left and right. The whole industry was an exciting engine of opportunity. Productivity soared. The productivity number is important because, like it or not, productivity drives wages and living standards. Upon close inspection, one might even say that the IT revolution in America was only possible, however, because the cost of IT equipment became very economical. Prices were dropping. And why were costs dropping? Intense competition among IT manufacturers had forced process innovation and thin margins. Back when I started high school in the late 90s, IBM laptops cost between $5,000 to $10,000. By graduation, they were closer to $2,000, and they were lighter in weight and longer in battery life. As a high school kid in California, the U.S. having a trade deficit in IT equipment benefited me a lot. Trade deficit? Good. Now for the second historical account, the solar industry in the early 2000s. Solar cells were invented in New Jersey, inside of Bell Labs. The invention was very popular. According to the U.S. Department of Energy's report from 2010, global demand for solar cells increased over 150% between 2007 and 2008, then another 75% the following year. However, interestingly enough, a report by a federal lab, the National Renewable Energy Lab, shows that by that exact time, only 6% of global solar cell production was stateside. Over 90% was outside the U.S. This was the inverse of only 4 years earlier, when the U.S. had been a net exporter of solar cells. That is, the U.S. had a trade surplus in the solar cells category. The reality is, according to Census Bureau data by 2009, America's solar cell trade deficit was almost $250 million. The question that should have been on everyone's mind is, if solar cells had been invented in the U.S. and the technology was widely popular, why was the solar cell manufacturing sector in the U.S. dead? The state of Massachusetts had even given a $60 million bailout to one of its local solar businesses called Evergreen Solar. But too little too late. By 2011, Evergreen Solar announced moving their remaining production to Asia. Sayonara. Had I been employed by Evergreen Solar in Massachusetts 9 years ago, I would have been utterly distraught by the solar cell trade deficit. Trade deficit? Bad. Depending upon which of the two industries hits closer to home, you could rightly conclude that outsourcing and globalization is either an innovation godsend or nightmare. Besides fixating only on whether goods will be cheaper, like the laptops were, or whether jobs will be cut, like in Evergreen Solar, is there an encompassing point of view to measure the benefits of outsourcing for both innovation and job security? Or would striving for both be wishful thinking? If you ask me, whether we are manufacturers, mayors, mothers, or all of the above, we want well-planned categories of trade surpluses and trade deficits. Some listeners might be asking why we're talking about outsourcing as though it's comparable to a national trade deficit, or the opposite of outsourcing, keeping the role in-house, as though in-house means national trade surplus. The reason is because these are indeed proxies of each other. Check it out. Just this morning, as I put butter on my bread, it was butter that I had not personally churned. Nope, I had my kids in quarantine do it. Just kidding, I don't have kids. It was butter that I received in exchange for my money. Someone else, in this case, the people at Kerrygold Irish Butter Company, could churn much more efficiently, economically, passionately than I could. Because I outsource my butter to Kerrygold Irish Butter Company, within the Esther economy, in my official trade category of butter, we have a deficit. And I'm happy with it, flabby arms and all. Same idea with other products and services that the Esther economy buys versus personally produces. When any of us want something, we make judgment calls on the best resource to use to meet the need. Is it our money, time, energy, or a combination? Do you see how the producer question is actually a microcosm of the trade question? One area where my outsourcing analogy doesn't map neatly onto a national trade deficit is outsourcing domestically versus overseas. But I think you can figure out how to zoom out or zoom in the metaphorical language as needed. Let's give credit to two professors whose research on this topic got my wheels turning. They are Gary Pisano and Willie Shia of the business school at Harvard. It was their writing on solar and IT equipment that I cited. On my Twitter feed, I will link to their concise and data-driven book published in 2012 titled Producing Prosperity: Why America Needs a Manufacturing Renaissance. The Harvard professors call a business's home the industrial commons. Think of it as the 1700s, when farmers led their livestock to pasture in public, shared, grassy spaces. That common area belonged to no specific person. but it was in everyone's best interest to maintain healthy grass. In the world of business, the Industrial Commons is the web of know-how, employable people, relationships, and everything in between to keep the industries oiled up and contenders for future growth. In the case of the American solar cell industry, this is what was missing. A strong and lively Industrial Commons did not exist. Turns out, many of the key components for solar cells are shared with a microelectronics industry. And by the early 2000s, where were the world's then most advanced and competitive microelectronics makers? You guessed it. Not in Massachusetts. They were over in the land of the rising sun. The world leaders of microelectronics were in Japan. You'll recognize the brands Sharp, Kyocera, and Sanyo. Now, some listeners out there might wonder, why did physical proximity matter? Couldn't Evergreen Solar just import parts while keeping the innovation work in-house? To that I say, excellent question. This is the key nuanced point when evaluating suitability of in-house versus outsourcing. Had Evergreen's product designs already been set in stone, then yes, outsource away. However, when a large part of the product is still being designed and tested, when the state of product development is still iterative, then the time to market is much faster and cheaper when the design team can walk down the street to a machine shop rather than fly halfway around the world. On top of this, having comfort with one's collaborative suppliers brings an ease of doing business. To be clear, I'm not saying that if businesses and their suppliers all speak the same language, everything will be collaborative and hunky-dory. Far from it. I am saying that frequency of contact matters. Why? Healthy partnerships between businesses have a foundation of trust and ideally respect. Trust and respect are much easier to establish and reinforce with more interaction. Even a casual 3-second interaction every couple of days will likely build more trust than a formal 3-hour meeting every 6 months. In a scenario that is mission critical, when time and accuracy are of the essence, when lives and livelihoods are at stake, people, businesses, and organizations will work with whomever they can count on to get the job done, whatever the first language, nationality, skin color, or myriad other sometimes divisive BS labels. When there's no room for error, you go to your A-team. You go to your special forces. Some rather Darwinian listeners out there might believe in the importance of an industrial commons and also believe that some industries actually should die out. Natural selection, anyone? Out with the old, in with the new, like AI, product design, and creative work. The old, unglamorous, dirt-under-the-fingernails manufacturing should naturally migrate to low-cost parts of the world, right? Hold that thought. Is it really that cut and dry? Is life ever? Instead of seeing the solar cells' industrial commons in isolation, what if we broadened our scope to see the additional likely technologies that could also emerge from the same industrial commons? We already know that Massachusetts lost out on becoming a solar hub because they lacked a supportive industrial commons. This begs the dreaded question, which additional, tangential, complementary industries also thrive in the same industrial commons of the microelectronics makers? I'll tell you a few. Flat panel screens, solid state lighting, optical coatings, light emitting diodes. These all feed at the same teat of microelectronics. And it gets worse for Massachusetts. Losing out on solar wasn't the only industry missed. All of the complementary industries I just listed, LED lights, etc., these aren't just any old industries. These are technologies that have significant growth potential of high-value innovation. While few people use CD players anymore, today the demand for rechargeable batteries, yes, yet another complementary industry of microelectronics, this related industry feeds a rapidly growing global appetite for hybrid and electric cars. Oh, what could have been for Massachusetts. Some of you out there might think I'm being a bit of a hoarder of business industries, as though I want all businesses currently alive in my city to stay in my city forever and ever. Amen. Let's return to that earlier excellent question. How do we know whether we're making wise decisions to outsource versus keep things in-house? I present to you the Harvard professor's 2x2 matrix that addresses this exact question on outsourcing. My twist, however, is I posit that we can use this matrix to answer not only whether outsourcing makes sense for an individual business, but also we can determine guidelines on which national trade categories should aim to be a surplus versus deficit at certain points in time. Now, time period is important because we know that economies around the country and around the world are at different stages of development. What's considered cutting edge in one economy might not remain so in another 10 years, let alone 30. Likewise, talent in one economy might not exist today, but in 30 years, it can very well if the educational system, visa policies, and available jobs shape the talent pool in a certain direction. So keep time periods in mind. No one uses identical playbooks in perpetuity. Likewise, we don't expect a company or economy to succeed without updating and improving its playbook season by season. I have posted this matrix to my Twitter feed. In the meantime, let me describe it. On the y-axis, we measure the maturity of the manufacturing process. On the x-axis, we measure the interdependence of product manufacturing with product design. Left is low, right is high. In a nutshell, the x-axis asks how important is the manufacturing process to innovating the product. Clear as mud? Let's look at examples. An example of an industry in quadrant one is book writing. Authors don't really need to care about the production process of book making. A more beautifully printed book cannot improve the writing content. Likewise, the book printers are not fussed about the quality of writing. There is zero economic upside to co-locating the author and the printers. Companies in quadrant one can and should use outsourcing as a competitive advantage. Moving on to quadrant two of the matrix, we see fine wine. Winemaking production is a mature process, but still, minute changes in that process can create major differences in the final product. If a business like winemaking wants to maintain their quality control, they'll think twice about outsourcing. At best, they can consider outsourcing specific segments like label printing. Turning to quadrant three, we see biotech drugs. Any product that requires trial and error and is intensely iterative, this new product cannot be invented without simultaneously inventing its own unique manufacturing process. A phrase that comes to mind is, jumping off a cliff, and building your wings on the way down. Products and pharmaceuticals, like discovering new vaccines, they must have a vertical supply chain if they wish to compete. If they can't compete, that is, they can't self-fund, then government support for public health initiatives usually make up the shortfall. Should companies in Quadrant 3 outsource? Altogether, everybody. No. Quadrant 3 companies must remain vertically integrated. They are best off being their own key suppliers. If they can't do that, they can consider an acquisition. Quadrant 3 companies especially need to live within a robust industrial commons. Finally, Quadrant 4. Here we see businesses producing the mechanical car part. Ford, BMW, Volvo, they can easily outsource their windshields or bumpers because for these car parts, industry design rules have already been established. Those of you especially caffeinated today might see some similarities between the mechanical car part company and the book writer. They are in different quadrants, yet they both have the freedom to dislocate their product designs and product manufacturing. Outsourcing works well for both quadrants. However, a massive advantage that companies in Quadrant 4 have is upside opportunity in the manufacturing process itself. For the car part maker in Quadrant 4, to create a competitive final product, the manufacturer will continuously innovate the production process. The company can upgrade machines to decrease defects while reducing scrap rate and increasing assembly line output. Perhaps counterintuitive to some listeners, in Quadrant 4, the product designers are the commodity, while the manufacturers are the unique differentiators. While there's no point in reinventing the wheel, for businesses in Quadrant 4, there's profit to be made by reinventing how to make the wheel. I'd say half of my own turbocharger company's strengths are here in Quadrant 4. The other half of our strengths is in inventing new technology. If you had to plot us on the matrix in the year 2020, you would be correct to put our aftermarket business in Quadrant 4 and our OEM innovation business in Quadrant 3. Earlier, I asked whether a set of future-oriented metrics could determine how to best support your business or local economy. If you start first with the matrix, you will be well on your way to identifying metrics for your situation. Or call me. I'd only be too happy and, frankly, honored to be a sounding board for you. For mayors looking for a framework on how to be smart about growing jobs, commission a study on the industrial commons. Find out which young technologies in your backyard need support. Understand the full picture of future technologies at risk if these nascent technologies don't take root and grow. Equally important, pinpoint which businesses are flattening their supply chains through outsourcing. Are they mature technologies in quadrants 1 or 4? As a policymaker, can you guide or incentivize their decisions? Check out Table 1-1 of the Harvard professor's book, Producing Prosperity. It lists 10 broad categories of industrial capabilities that are already gone or at risk in the U.S. It's an endangered species list. I have already posted this table to Twitter. Let's not be willy-nilly about positioning for prosperity. For millions of families across the country and around the world, our futures count on each other to individually understand sensible and informed future jobs planning. by proactively and intelligently cultivating the appropriate industrial commons of high potential businesses for our backyards. We will have trade deficits and trade surpluses that are wisely planned, maximizing our resources and cooperation, creating a world that doesn't feel quite so hopeless and zero-sum. Needless to say, while no job is future-proof, every job has value. What's tricky yet core to managing a business or economy is knowing how to organize and rearrange jobs and their supporting subsystems over a long time horizon. As we'll see in our next episode, when government policy and industries both support the common good for the long haul, everyone wins big time. So practice having a macro view. The IT and solar cell industries remind us to see the forest through the trees. After all, there's only one evergreen I'd like to be, and it's not the one planted in a dried-up commons. And that's it for this episode. Next time, we'll put on our historian hats. We'll look at reasons for the rise of the American industrial commons after World War II, causes of its erosion, and solutions on how to reverse the decline. I bet some of you can already see how the Great Game of Business system fits in. Thank you all for your time. My contact information is in the show notes. Signing off until next episode, I'm Esther Tang. Remember that you count and you matter to me.